Welcome to the sixth episode, segment one of LDS Women's Book Review. We're happy to have you here with us. I'm Shanda, here with my friends
Sheila
and Hillary.
And we are here to talk about 1776 by David McCullough. I'm going to start with some quick news first before we go into the discussion of the book. Our contest is still going on for Stephanie Black's The Believer, an autographed copy. The three ways to enter are on the website, so I'm not going to go into them now, but check out the website at www.ldswomensbookreview.com and you'll find out all the information you need to know there. The contest goes until August 18th at 11:59 Mountain Daylight Time. You can keep posting and emailing and whatever you need to do to get your name entered into a drawing to win the autographed copy of The Believer by Stephanie Black. Some other news we have, well, Rob Wells' The Counterfeit was released July 5th. He has been doing book signings at various places. His book signing schedule is actually in our forum. So if you want to know where you can meet Rob Wells and have him sign your books, find a copy of The Counterfeit, then you can look there and see where he's going to be signing his books and be able to say hello. Also, on Friday, July 7th, he had a book release party at the Siegel Book and Tape on 90th and Redwood here in Salt Lake, and I was able to go and meet him and his lovely wife, Erin, and get him to sign all my books, picked up a copy of The Counterfeit, and we also had our picture taken with him, he and my husband, and those pictures are up on the website if you want to go take a look under the book signing party link in the latest news section. And I believe that's all of the news that we have. I can't think of anything else other than keep listening and posting on the forum. We have so many good posts now, lots of activity on the forum that has picked up since we had the contest. So come and read the post and join in and get your name entered into the drawing. Do you guys have anything else you want to add?
No, just come and join us, please.
We've been having a lot of fun, believe it or not. Do you guys want to talk about your recent reading? Before we get into
I've only read one other book.
You what better book? Go ahead first then.
I just read Scream Free Parenting, which is pretty good.
Ooh, who wrote that book?
It's Hal Edward Runkel. He's not LDS, but he's definitely Christian. He brings out different points of best way to discipline your child using more type Christian type methods. But it's very, he doesn't call it love and logic, but he uses a lot of love and logic. And
I love love and logic.
And you know, most parenting books, it's funny, they won't call it that, but that's what it is. But he did bring out some really, really good points that one in particular that I have definitely made a change with my kids, that it's labeling, you know, and I could go on for hours about what labels do to your kids, but. So I switched words instead of saying, you can be such a little twerp. I just say things like, I don't call them twerps. Well, not all the time anyway. But I'll say something instead of you can, you are. Instead of saying you are a little twerp, you say you can be such a cute little twerp. And that's better because it's saying you can be that instead of you are that. And that labels them automatically. So I've watched myself very carefully how I'm talking to my children now. So that was a good thing. Took me 2 weeks to read it, but it was a good thing. Good book.
Scream Free Parenting.
Long list at the library, but good book.
I'm going to go put my name on the list. How about you, Sheila?
Well, let me first preface this, that I am on not spring break. I'm on summer vacation from teaching preschool, so I tend to read a little bit more when I am during the summer. And so this is why my list is very long of what I have read. I really went on a Beverly Lewis readathon since we last met. There is a series of Beverly Lewis books called Abram's Daughters. They are fantastic. There are 5 books: The Covenant, The Betrayal, The Sacrifice, The Prodigal, and The Revelation.
You read all those?
They're not really long books. They're maybe 200, 300 pages each.
And okay.
See, that's not
like,
really
that's how long this one
was.
Well, you read 700 page books in a day and a half.
I know.
So.
Sometimes that doesn't take me too long. But wonderful story, wonderful family in the series of books. I loved these characters. Even more so than in Annie's People, The Preacher's Daughter that we read. I love this family. Another Beverly Lewis book I read, it's a combination book of 3 of her books in one. It was, like, really huge. It's called Amish Country Crossroads. It includes The Postcard, The Crossroad and Sanctuary.
I thought you were going to say Amish Country Cookbook.
The way it was
they
going.
Have one. They have really. One. I want to get that. I mean, after you read all these Amish books, and
you'll have to churn
wonderful.
Your own butter, you know.
Oh,
so I think that fresh churned butter would be delicious. I think it'd be worth it personally, but you know.
But I also, at Hillary's advice, I read The Da Vinci Code in a 24-hour period. I could not put it down. The murder mystery, and that is fantastic. Mm. We'll talk about that next month, but very good. And because of that, I just checked out from the library Secrets of the Code, The Unauthorized Guide to the Mysteries Behind the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
When I read something like this, I always like to learn just a little bit more. I'm just curious. That's what kind of person I am. Well, I want to read more. And also, for all you Harry Potter fans out there, I found this great book called The Plot Thickens, Harry Potter Investigated by Fans for Fans. It is a wonderful book. It's just people giving all their theories, and so it's fun. It is entertaining. I just kind of read it in little snippets, you know, when I have nothing else to do. I kind of pick it up and can read a chapter.
Nothing else to do.
I was just going to say, people that if they manage to get a book published about their theories about Harry Potter, which who really does not exist.
Oh, but it's wonderful.
It's amazing.
So much fun. So much fun. and now there was one book I read that was not a fiction book. It's called Fast Food Fix. 75 Amazing Recipe Makeovers of Your Fast Food Restaurant Favorites.
Ooh,
and
I like
it's
those
by things. Devin Alexander. And the good thing is she's taken all of these really heavy, fat-filled,
like
foods.
Like fettuccine Alfredo.
Well, just everything. You can think
but
of
that's
pizza.
That's what makes them good.
But she's changed them to make them lower fat, but they
well,
still taste good.
Well, they're not good.
You know, they still look like they're really good. I haven't tried a lot of them, but... So it's just kind of
have
fun.
Have you tried some of them?
Yeah, I have, and they taste pretty good. But they're just not as fattening.
I like cookbooks. I like to flip through
too.
Them. So every now and then I'll go on a cookbook run at the library
right.
and check out like 15
fun.
Cookbooks. And
I have a whole collection. I have a whole cupboard full of recipes.
I do too.
And cookbooks. No, I'll tell you how often I actually cook. And it just is not proportionate to
well,
the amount of recipes
true.
I have.
But the fun thing about this, she has little stories behind a lot of the recipes and how she found them and how she figured them out. So, you know, it was fun reading, but...
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that one out.
That's it, including the other ones. But yeah.
Cookbooks, you can at least flip through them. You don't
exactly.
have to devote 3 hours to reading it or 4 hours or something.
Well, that's
so.
What I like about the Harry Potter books. Yeah. You can read one little chapter, one theory, then you can go to the
Well, that's what I liked about this book, that Against All Odds, that we just read.
Exactly.
Is that I read it in between calls,
exactly.
and I got to read a full story, and then my phone would ring, and then read a full story, phone would ring. So it worked out perfect.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about that one, actually.
Yeah. I actually bookmarked that one.
My recent reads. Let's see, what have I finished reading? Well, I read 1776. And I read Against All Odds. I finished The Christ Commission. I don't know if I think that I finished it after the last month's podcast. And I also, let's see, what did I finish? I think I read one other book, and I'm pulling a blank on what it was. I think it was a nonfiction book, actually. But you know what? It doesn't matter. Because obviously it didn't make that big of an impression on me. Well, let's move on to 1776, since we don't really have a big news or lots of recent reading to talk about. So, I don't have any formalized outline of talking about this book, so let's just talk. Let's start at the beginning.
I like the pictures.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Very nice, Hillary.
The portraits are really interesting.
Well, a lot of them are very famous.
Yeah, there are some
portraits that
there.
Are in here also. That's what's fun. But you know what? This is a very, very well-written history book.
Yes.
And I've heard from many of my fellow family members that are big-time readers like I am. My brother, my mother-in-law, my father-in-law have also read 1776 and also other books by David McCullough.
John Adams.
Yeah, the John Adams and Truman. And they all said they're very, very good. And you know what? He writes really well. I mean, as far as history books go,
yes.
he does a very, very
You know, once you get
job.
Into the story and it starts picking up, it really, especially if you like to read history and you just plow through and you don't worry about some of the wording that is a little bit difficult to understand sometimes when in quotes mainly, not
yeah,
in David McCullough's writing. Anyway, once you plow through it, it's actually really fascinating. I was turning pages like crazy yesterday. I was just plowing through this book, the end of it, because I enjoyed it, because it was really picking up, and I wanted to see what happened next. And I like how, I expected it to be more detailed, but it really, it included big details, but it didn't go into deep, deep detail that you feel like you need to bring out your notebook when you're back in college or something. It summarizes in a very enigmatic way the story of 1776, and I learned a lot from this, actually. You know, I earned a new respect for George Washington, I'll tell you that.
Well, I think you also, don't you agree, Shonda, that you also just have a deep respect for the Americans, or that we're going to soon be true Americans.
The rebels.
Mm-hmm. Yes! Mm-hmm. What they went through, what they sacrificed. I mean, we've always heard those stories about all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, what happened to all of them, but what about the little normal farmers?
What about the rabble,
yes,
as the British call them?
Exactly.
Rabble in arms.
You know, you hear what they went through and how dedicated they truly were to what they were doing.
Well, what interested me is I didn't get as far as you guys in the book, but I liked the first part just talking about how unorganized. I mean, I realized it was, I knew rebellions are never, you know, like the British Army, you know, clockwork, this is how perfect it's going to be. But I didn't realize just how disparaging the circumstances were.
I was really discouraging at first.
I was discouraged, very discouraged, going, there's no... And then I'm like, duh, Hillary, it's not a novel. So, you know, going, okay, I know what the outcome is. But still, it's just like, how did he do it? And, you know, how could he possibly bring such no money, very little food, such illness, and keep it together?
Barely.
Barely by the skin of their teeth. And George Washington, yeah. Just, wow, what a guy.
The book starts out in 1775, in the last half of 1775, and he starts with King George III. He was probably one of the better kings they've had. You know, but the part I have marked on here was in Parliament, he gave a speech, and King George III, this is what David McCullough wrote, he hoped his people in America would see the light and recognize... And this is quoting King George III now, that to be a subject of Great Britain, with all its consequences, is to be the freest member of any civil society in the known world. And I found that quote very ironic, coming from 200 plus years later. You know, that it was, it's to be the freest member of any civil society in the known world. And that would be true, because
at the known world. At the time, yeah.
At the time.
Which is interesting, considering Australia doesn't want to be part of England anymore. Canada, I don't know how they feel, but, you know, it's just like no one seems to want to be part of it anymore.
Well, motto used to be Make the World England? Because they were going to be the next great empire. And for a while, they were.
That's true. And, you know, with King George, he just treated the American rebels as if they were children.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's just tame them. Or like little doggies or something. All we have to do is tame them. It will be fine. You know, they'll soon come around. It was just like, ew.
And do what I thought was funny
is that?
Is when he sent that, the letter got to the troops about this speech, I think it was. And they freaked. And instead of it getting the accomplished effect that he wanted,
it made him more mad.
Lit the fire. Exactly. They were able to retreat, you know, have more members come back to the forces.
The ironic thing is, and something I never knew, is that even when all of this was going on and they had the Boston Tea Party thing, this was a year later, you know, later that year anyway, that there was never any mention of independence at the beginning.
There wasn't.
They just wanted some leniency. They didn't want to be taxed so heavily, whatever the problem was.
Yeah, but then that word kept creeping up there, I can say. Did you notice that? Even in the beginning, they very gently would mention it here or there, and then you're just like,
well,
wow.
the British would mention it. Mm-hmm. The British would say,
that's what I mean.
For independence. And this is what Earl of Shelburne said over in England. Is it their intention, is it the intention of the British or the administration, parliament, whatever, by thus perpetually sounding independence in the ears of the Americans to lead them to it? By, you know, even though the Americans had never said anything about independence, the British were automatically putting that, kind of making it seem that way, maybe to justify their actions wanting to be harder on them. And, you know, it's like, you give them the idea, fine, then give them
the idea.
We
thank them for their idea.
Yes, don't you love that it was a Brit in Parliament that first referred to the rebels as the Sons of Liberty?
Sons of Liberty.
I love that.
That was funny, wasn't it?
Yes, you know, they gave them the title, but right there, it shows that they were thinking that that's what would happen.
Do you know what I forgot about, too, was just how many loyalists there were in the country at the same time yes. that were causing problems and different...
Getting in the way
and different right. things. And I completely forgot. I kept thinking that when, you know, the pilgrims came and that the whole thing started, it was people that had no desire to have anything to do with England. When in reality, quite a few of them came over here to help... Exactly. Or to set up government, so it mimicked England's, and were still very loyal to the crown. And it's like, oh, they were I forgot still about English that. But there was this big division between who is loyal and who wasn't, and the trouble it caused.
That's true. Because they were not only fighting the British troops.
They were fighting the loyalists.
They were. They were fighting their own fellow...
Neighbors.
Their neighbors. That's a good
way to
put it.
They mentioned they didn't want... that some of the people who were against the war in the Parliament were against British citizens shedding the blood of other British citizens. Because it was technically like a civil war.
I guess it was the original civil war here, wasn't it?
That's true.
I have to look at it that way.
I have to mention this about Nathaniel Greene.
He's funny. I like him. He's a good guy. Yeah, maybe not funny, but he's definitely
he was a good, interesting man. Yeah, it was very interesting to see the key players in this whole thing in 1776. Even if it wasn't in the whole war. But this quote really caught my attention since we're such book readers. It was a day and age that saw no reason why one could not learn whatever was required, learn virtually anything, by the close study of books. And he was a prime example of such faith. Nathaniel Greene studied a lot, and you know, that's how they learned everything.
Wasn't Henry Knox, too, the one that had the London bookstore?
Yeah, the huge
bookstore. Yeah, that has huge name on it. And so the name is, I thought that was funny, too. But
his name
but
was
they
bigger
learned
than the name
all
of the store.
That they needed to know about war and... From books.
Yes.
And yet, isn't that amazing if you think about it? Our little podunk, you know, leaders learned everything they knew from books. I mean, George Washington hadn't even served in, he hadn't been a leader in a war before?
No.
And here he's a general.
A small one, but he never led an entire army.
But
or
he never led the entire army,
battle.
Is what I'm saying. Mm-mm. And you look at that, and we learned our strategies and military information from books. And yet we still managed to beat the Britons. Fascinating.
No, starting out, they really did not have a good situation.
No.
And the gunpowder situation, really, they had 9 shots. I have to read this. They had, I think it was 9 shots per man. That's how much gunpowder they had for the whole militia.
And yet they were shooting at birds, starting their fires with a gunshot. It's like, what are you doing?
At present, there was powder enough only for about 9 rounds per man. According to one account, Washington was so stunned by the report, he did not utter a word for half an hour. What could you say? What could you say? You can say anything. That's just amazing to me.
I wanted to bring out the point, it's on page 43. It's talking about the appointment of George Washington as, you know, the commander-in-chief. It says, John Adams, who had put Washington's name in nomination for the command, described him in a letter to his wife, Abigail. And I like what he says here. He says, this appointment will have great effect in cementing and securing the union of these colonies. And he prophesied that Washington could become one of the most important characters in the world. And you think about it now. That was a true prophecy because see what has happened nowadays. You know, everyone knows who George Washington is.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone, even those people on Jay Leno at night when they... who was George Washington?
Jaywalking.
Yeah, they're jaywalking. No, they know who George Washington was. He's the first president of the United States. You know, they may
That's about
know.
All they know. But
you know, at least they know that. You know,
I have to add what his wife Abigail Adams wrote in return.
Okay.
It is good. What you just quoted. Right. Abigail wrote to tell her, after she had met the general herself for the first time, she wrote to tell her husband he'd hardly said enough.
Yeah, they didn't talk enough for her.
No, hardly said, no, he hardly said enough about Washington.
He should have said more.
He was what her husband said and more.
Right.
And I think that's just wonderful.
Well, and it also goes on to describe him. It says, Washington's effect on the troops and young officers was striking. Joy was visible on every countenance, according to Nathaniel Greene, and it seemed as if the spirit of conquest breathed through the whole army. How many times through this book is it Washington
that inspires the troops?
Rounds the troops up and gets, okay, guys, you know, we can do this, and it's that perseverance we were talking about.
It's
this
not
earlier.
Just his words. His
no,
words.
It's
his
words
actions.
Behind,
but they mentioned his words a little bit, but what really made an impression was his appearance,
yes.
How he behaved in battle, and how he... Just how
well, and they talk about how the other generals are so, like the one that hops off his horse and chucks the rock, is that what it was? can't remember his name. What was his name? Shoot. Anyway, but they were so laid back and kind of more blended in with the troops. Like, they were just, you know, farmers that became majors. And,
right.
And then you've got General Washington, who's not ever really led an army, and yet he's so regal, almost, mm-hmm. compared to these other guys that are just kind of
whatever.
Well,
didn't they say he lived like the English...
Yes, every aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
Now, one thing that was really interesting to me about the army, the militia, the New Englanders wouldn't wash their own clothes because of this woman's
that
work.
Kills
so
me.
They were so dirty.
I'm like, you would rather smell like that and because it was woman's work? I'm just like, oh my word.
I know that. Well, one thing I noticed in here when they were talking about deserters, they didn't have pictures. And they might not have even had artists to be able to draw, or a way to...
Also, they describe what they're wearing.
They describe their mannerisms and things. And I just have...
That's funny.
I have to read some of these because it just cracked me up. Okay. Let's see. Likewise, Matthias Smith, a small, smart fellow, a saddler by trade, gray-headed, has a younger look in his face, is apt to say, I swear, and between his words will spit smart. Had on a green coat, an old red greatcoat. He's a right gamester, although he wears something of a sober look. You know,
can you imagine a wanted poster sitting up there, and it's of this two paragraphs of what the guy looks like?
I swear.
It's like,
I think that's rather smart though, because people have a hard time changing their mannerisms.
Yeah, but half the people couldn't read. I'm just the other general. He couldn't even write his name, I think is what it was. So I'm like, why did they even put descriptions of people? It'd be better to draw a stick figure and color it in or something.
Because they can be read to, I guess. But they can say what they're wearing because they had three or four outfits max, if anything. Yeah. And so the clothes could be reliable.
That's true. At the time, it would be a joke nowadays. But.
Okay, now, you guys were talking about what Washington had to, who the men were that he had to use to help fight this war. On page 66, it's really interesting. You know, they're talking about the men and, you know, how they're not experienced, they're not really soldiers, they're farmers. And this is what Washington responds after everyone's bemoaning their tribulations and what's going on. He says, "Let me ask you, sir, when is the time for brave men to exert themselves in the cause of liberty and their country? If this is not, he understood the troubles that they all faced, but we must bear up against them and make the best of mankind as they are, since we cannot have them as we wish." Doesn't that go right along with what we're talking about? Yeah. I mean, okay, this is what I have. We have to make the best of it. I mean, this is how Washington looked at it constantly. I mean,
he wasn't happy about it, but he didn't let it discourage him.
Right.
He still was determined. I liked that. I was looking at page 48. Washington's influence on Congress and serving with no pay. That's what I have in my notes here.
I can't believe how long they went out.
The feeling, this is what it was.
And wives and children at home with nothing.
Well,
wow.
What was the option? To be ruled by tyranny? Well. You know? The feeling was that if he, George Washington, who had so much, was willing to risk his all, however daunting the odds, then who were they to equivocate? That he was also serving without pay was widely taken as further evidence of the genuineness of his commitment.
True.
Like I said, I earned a whole new respect for Washington in reading this book. Nobody's perfect. He wasn't perfect.
They all made mistakes. Not interesting.
But man, if he isn't an example. You know?
I agree.
What did you think about the Navy situation? Or lack thereof.
Was there a Navy?
armed schooners. They had armed schooners, I believe. Oh, this is one of the ones I wanted to talk about, the divine references.
Ooh, I would love to talk about that also, Shanda.
That was one of the things that struck me through this book, was just how coincidental some of the storms were. And even though everything wasn't just handed to them in a silver platter, conditions were not ideal. The men were not ideal. But there were certain instances where, because this was meant to happen, it was just too coincidental. Anyway, there's a quote here. It says, let's see, the Lee is a ship. It was called the Lee. The Lee was one of the first of several armed schooners Washington had sent out to prey on enemy shipping. It was a first triumph for his new navy because the Lee had captured the Nancy. off of Cape Ann, north of Boston, and they had, it said it was loaded with military treasure. War material, guns.
Except course, no gunpowder.
No powder.
Darn it. I really needed.
I thought that was funny.
But it said it was a first triumph for his new, quote, Navy, and John Manley a first hero. He was the captain of the Lee. It was an instance of divine favor, for nothing surely ever came more apropos. Washington wrote immediately to Joseph Reed. So that was one of the things, that was one of the first things that Washington always acknowledges God in the things that he says and does, which I really like.
He does, and on page 79 he does that. If you turn to page 79, this is during a time when he was very, very forlorn. He wasn't sleeping at night. He was just trying to reflect on the situation and what's going to happen. He says, few people know the predicament we're in. But down at the bottom of page 79, it references Providence.
That's one of the ones I have marked.
Is that one that you had marked also? I love it because he says, if I shall be able to rise superior to these and many other difficulties which might be enumerated, I shall most religiously believe that the finger of Providence is in it to blind the eyes of our enemies. For surely if we get well through this month, it must be for want of their knowing the disadvantages we labor under.
Because they don't understand. It's just amazing to me that the enemy, the British, had no idea the situation, how bad it was. If they knew how bad off the militia was with no army, or no powder, I mean, and the army just in all sorts of disarray, they could have wiped us out in one.
They were a little arrogant, though. I mean, well, very arrogant.
Very arrogant. Not
there you go. But they describe, I can't remember which one it was now. That's what I get for reading at night. But, described, he was incredibly intelligent, and he made the suggestion of just a quick get it done, and if they'd followed his plan, we wouldn't exist. And instead, yes. Because he's a little bit more laxy-daisy, and, I'll do it on my own time, and what have you.
They had a certain tradition of war. They had a certain tradition of war that worked for them in the past, but was...
Oh, well, this is guerrilla war.
Wasn't adapted. Exactly. It wasn't adapted for war here in the Americas, which is amazing to me, considering the French and Indian War. They wouldn't have learned a little bit more from that. There were a few,
but they're the British. They didn't need to learn.
There were a few, veterans from the French and Indian War, but not near enough, apparently, that can remember that. I have a quote from Nathaniel Green in a fervent letter to Samuel Ward in Philadelphia, is how David McAuliffe refers to it. This is what Nathaniel Green wrote to Samuel Ward. Heaven hath decreed that tottering empire, Britain, to irretrievable ruin, and thanks to God, since Providence hath so determined, America must raise an empire of permanent duration, supported upon grand pillars of truth, freedom, and religion, encouraged by the smiles of justice, and defended by her own patriotic sons. Permanent duration, supported on the grand pillars of truth, freedom, and religion.
We need to, email that around or something.
Tripods are sturdy. You put three legs on a stool, you have a very sturdy stool. Put four, not so much. But you take away one of those three legs, and what is America teetering on right now?
Religion.
Truth? Yes. Yeah. Freedom? All right. Religion is very much threatened.
And here we go back to the believer.
Exactly.
We see what happens when the religion is gone from a country.
I know that's fiction, but that's...
That she based it on...
It's true. That's what would really happen.
Truth.
That's
right.
We all know that's what would happen if religion was taken out. And I just think that was... There were references in here to people who, they referred to us Yankees as Bible-faced and things like that. So they were obviously atheists or non-religious people serving in all throughout the British and even in the Americas. But grand pillars of truth, freedom, and religion—that just it just struck me so strongly because of what we're facing today.
Very much so.
It's no wonder they say that the Constitution will hang as if by a thread.
Ooh, whenever I hear that, it just gives me chills because you see so many instances of this happening today. Constantly, where the Constitution is threatened. Let's change this in the Constitution. Let's change that. Let's leave this out.
And it's all based on religion. And
yes.
We're not even free to practice our own religions anymore. They want such a separation between the government and the religion that it's almost like it's starting to feel like as a Christian you can't even believe in God without being ridiculed, period, because that means you want the church to take over the government, right. and that's not true.
Right. Yeah, another word that I think was repeated over and over and over and over again in this book is miracle. They kept referring to after the miracle, like just after the miracle of this war or this battle, and after the miracle of them being able to, you know, get across the Delaware and back again without the British knowing.
Overnight, I know that. I mean,
there were just all these references. I mean, truly, you could see the hand of God helping them, even though so much was against them. That word is so appropriate for what happened during that whole year. Well, through the whole Revolutionary War, you could see how we all know now why we had to have America, why we had to have a free nation.
We as LDS.
Yes, we do. As LDS, we know why Joseph Smith needed this true, free country.
This freedom.
Yes, to do what he wanted to do, finding the religion he wanted to worship. But back then, you know, they probably didn't realize what was happening, but they acknowledged the fact that there were miracles happening.
In fact,
love it.
On page 92, there's another part I marked. The book goes on to say, it's talking about, let's see, what is Dave McCullough is writing about the progress up steep, smooth slopes that was difficult. And I'm trying to remember where they were going here. But either way, this is what David wrote. The night was unseasonably mild, indeed perfectly beautiful with a full moon. Ideal conditions for the work, as if the hand of the Almighty were directing things, which the Reverend William Gordon, like many others, felt certain it was.
Yes.
A finer night for working could not have been taken out of the whole 365, he wrote. It was hazy below the heights so that our people could not be seen, though it was a bright moonlit night above on the hills. I think this is actually when they were moving on to Dorchester Heights.
I think you're right.
In the night, yep. In secret, and the British had no idea. It was just amazing how that worked. Well, they wake up singing. They wake up in the morning and there's the rebels on Dorchester Heights. And they could have taken, the British could have taken Dorchester Heights, but they didn't think it was that, you know, they knew it was going to be integral, but they weren't worried too much about it.
And they thought we'd be polite enough to wait till morning.
Exactly.
In the dark of night, and boom, there we were.
They didn't think that they would be able to do it. They never gave the rebels credit that they would be able to do something like that.
Not at first.
Or that they would think, you know, later on, and near the end.
If you think about it, neither did Darth Vader.
Oh,
or Voldemort. Voldemort with Harry.
Exactly.
They never do. The leader of whoever is the superior,
proud,
whatever
arrogant
thing, they never think that a little rebel has that ability. It squashed them like a bug theory. Mm-hmm. And it just always goes the other way. Have you ever noticed that?
Bug's life.
The ants. Necessity is the mother of invention. Yes. And when you're in a tight spot and it's good against evil, then you'll find a way.
Good
or at least
always prevail. Yes.
But unfortunately, in real life, that's not true.
I wish it was that way in real life. But
here's another example. This is what the book says. The morning after, the winds continued to blow with a fury. The snow and sleet had changed to driving rain. General Heath concluded that kind heaven had stepped in to intervene. And so it seemed to many on both sides when that morning Howe called off the attack and gave orders to prepare to evacuate Boston. Kind heaven had stepped in to intervene.
That's wonderful. You know, it's interesting. John Adams, he was writing about, this is after they declared their independence. He says, we are in the very midst of a revolution, the most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of nations. And of course, we all know what it said in the Declaration of Independence, that Thomas Jefferson, it says he drafted, declared it self-evident that all men are created equal, and were endowed with the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to this noble end, the delegates had pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. I love that.
And in reply to that, page 141, just a few pages later,
yes,
this is the other side of the coin. News of the Declaration of Independence served only to underscore, in quotations, the villainy and the madness of these deluded people. An outraged Ambrose Searle,
Right.
Observed. A more impudent, false, and atrocious proclamation was never fabricated by the hands of man. Now, who's deluded?
Yeah. Yeah, who's the man?
who's deluded now? They really didn't think that the rebels knew what they were. Nothing more false had ever been fabricated by the hands of men.
They never took seriously what we were saying.
And do you know what? If they had taken us seriously, I think maybe we would have had a different war on our hands.
Possibly.
I agree.
You know, ultimately, we were British subjects, and we just needed to be reminded of our place. That was the extent of it.
Have our little hands slapped a little bit, and then off we go.
What did you guys think about that interview? You might not have gotten this far, because this is on page 144 to 146. The interview between George Washington and the British officer that brought that letter that was addressed to Mr. Washington, et cetera, whatever. And he didn't accept the letter because it wasn't addressed appropriately to George Washington's station. And the British wouldn't recognize him as the general.
Right. I love that, and he sent him away until he came back.
Well, they came. Correctly. Joseph Reed sent him away. But when George Washington actually received the man, and the letter just sat there.
He didn't open it.
He wouldn't touch it. And I think, let's see, I'm wondering if I have a quote here, if I just wrote it down. Oh, I love how the meeting over, as Patterson himself would write, he's the British officer that came to speak with George Washington. The meeting over, as Patterson himself would write, the general, then this is what is quoting Patterson, with a great deal of marked attention and civility, permitted me to take my leave. This is what Washington told him. Those who have committed no fault want no pardon, because they were offering pardons to the rebels if they would, you know, drop the cause. And those who have committed no fault want no pardon, Washington said plainly. We are only defending what we deem our indisputable rights. According to Henry Knox, the English officer appeared as awestruck, as if before something supernatural. That, you know, they just didn't really believe that we were serious, that the rebels were serious. I know. I say we as if it was us.
Well, it was
our forefathers.
We are here enjoying the freedoms today because of what they went through.
No, I don't think that Britain was evil. That, okay,
no,
the
no
nice,
they weren't.
The nice
I
thing,
agree.
The nice thing about this book is he presents both sides very equably.
He does an excellent job of that.
There's our point of view, and there's the British point of view. And it doesn't make the British seem evil or bad, or you can really understand the British point of view. And being, if I were living in London, I'd probably be feeling the same way about the rebels as they did. Mm-hmm. Being an American, I'm a little more favorable towards
the Americans.
But, you know, I can. It shows both points of view, and you can see why they wouldn't want to lose America because it was so rich.
Oh, and they did not realize the richness of America.
They didn't even realize how big it was. They had no idea how big America was.
They did not realize any of that until the troops were off, and they come to a town and come to a plantation and see all the food and just everything.
Well, even the Americans didn't know how far back it went. It's only 1776.
One of the Britons said that he'll march with his 5,000 troops across the whole of the American continent.
From one to the other.
It's like, oh, buddy, you'd be taking several years to do that.
At least. Constant marching.
Oh, they never would have made it.
Especially if
once the Native Americans got a hold of them, they'd be gone.
No, the people of America didn't even know how big of a country they were living in. And that is something that, you know, with all of the maps and everything that we have, and all the maps they had of the known world, it's interesting to realize that nobody really understood how big America was.
Until they sent Lewis and Clark out to map it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
which would happen many years later.
Many years later.
There's really something, I love this quote, it's way back on page 190 near the end of the book. You know, the troops had held the line one night, and is counting the hours until they could be relieved and escape with the others who waited now in the dark. He said it was a moment of extreme difficulty trying business to young soldiers, as Alexander Graydon wrote. And this is the part I love. It says, whoever has seen troops in a similar situation or dully contemplates the human heart in such trials well knows how to appreciate the conduct of these brave men on this occasion. It just makes you almost cry because you think of the sacrifice that they made and how they stood there. And I mean, they were the ones left behind. Seriously,
they were the ones.
Yes, they had to stay back there and hold the line, and they did it.
Another thing that was interesting to me that I didn't realize, on the other side of the coin, the civilians, and on page 158, it says, in fact, the Americans of 1776 enjoyed a higher standard of living than any people in the world.
That was interesting.
Their material wealth was considerably less than it would become in time. Mm-hmm. Still, it was a great deal more than others had elsewhere. How people with so much living on their own land would ever choose to rebel against the ruler God had put over them.
Now that's from the British viewpoint.
Yes.
That's definitely British.
And thereby bring down such devastation upon themselves was for the invaders incomprehensible.
That's a good quote.
No, they just didn't understand, and I can see that. You know, I can see from their point of view how that would be hard.
Well, you have to think, for how many years had they been under the rule of a king? That was just their way of life. Mm-hmm.
One last Providence quote here, page 191. And this was...
That's where I'm at.
That's where you are. Page 191. It says, incredibly, yet again, circumstances, fate, luck, providence, the hand of God, as would be said so often, intervened. Just at daybreak, a heavy fog settled in over the whole of Brooklyn, concealing everything no less than had the night. It was a fog so thick, remembered a soldier, that one could scarcely discern a man at 6 yards' distance. Even with the sun up, the fog remained as dense as ever, while over on the New York side of the river, there was no fog at all.
Fascinating.
Isn't that interesting?
The hand of God.
It just was, you know, they needed little help. I mean, they had to do all the work. The rebels, they had to fight, they had to suffer, they had no shoes. In the dead of winter, and they had hardly any clothing on them. There was so much sickness and disease and death and just a lack of food, so much struggle. It's just amazing to me that they even got through that first year.
It was a miracle. That word again, it was a miracle. Something that Shanda and I had commented on, most people don't realize how long the Revolutionary War really went on. It did not end until 1783 at the Treaty of Paris, which ended the war.
It was 6 years.
So, it was a long time. It started 1775 and went till 1783. So
6, 8 years. Isn't it?
8 years. It was an 8-year war.
It's a long war.
It really is. And this was just the beginning. And you think, most people think, 1776, they fought that little war and got our independence. But it went on for a long time. There was a lot of sacrifice.
I tell you, I didn't get enough. I need to read some good books on the American Revolution, because this was great for 1776, but this was the tip of the iceberg for me. I was sad when it was over. I wanted to know more. I wanted it to keep going.
I agree. I enjoyed this book.
There were a couple of points I wanted to talk about as far as nowadays. On page 225, there's a quote from Joseph Reed, who was George Washington's right-hand man, the secretary, that he trusted so much. And I'm trying to figure out if I don't know if I marked it, but it was a description of the difficulty. Yes. We're on page 220. Oh, yes, that's right. To attempt to introduce discipline and subordination into a new army must always be a work of much difficulty, Reed wrote to his wife. But where the principles of democracy so universally prevail, where so great an equality and so thorough a leveling spirit predominates, either no discipline can be established, or he who attempts it must become odious and detestable, a position which no one will choose. So where, in the Americas, everyone already felt equal to each other, and to have someone try and take the lead who was amongst their... is the same level as they saw themselves. They resented people taking charge and trying to. And I wonder if Heavenly Father feels that way about us sometimes.
That's an interesting
does that make sense? I put on here, I wonder if that is how Heavenly Father feels and why obedience can be so hard for some people, because they resent. It says here, I wrote here, in order. Tries to introduce order in a place where people are threatened by authority and someone they perceive is trying to tell them what to do, even when it is good for them.
Why don't we tell our kids?
I wonder if that is how Heavenly Father feels and why obedience can be so hard for some people.
I'm sure.
Because they resent anyone trying to tell them what to do whom they see as their equal or they're just as good as them, instead of the humility. Exactly. That's why humility is so important.
Yes.
And being sure of yourself, knowing that they don't have to be threatened by someone else, especially if it's for their good. Being able to see the big picture. The last thing I wanted to talk about was Mercy Warren. She's a woman who was an author.
Yes.
And on her quote on page 291 was very interesting to me. Mercy Warren, the wife of James Warren and an author, would write in her own history of the American Revolution that there were perhaps no people on earth in whom a spirit of enthusiastic zeal is so readily kindled and burned so remarkably as among Americans. And I Woo-hoo! Think that is even true today.
I agree.
We have such patriotic zeal, and even though we can be pretty lax... Well, listen, you know, even though Americans be pretty relaxed, we take for granted everything that we have. If it's threatened or if something happens, that zeal comes up. That zeal comes forward.
That was evident after 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
That's one quote that I would like to say before we end,
yes.
just to kind of sum up Washington and who he was, it's the very last page. It says, without Washington's leadership and unrelenting perseverance, which is the word he used constantly, mm-hmm. we need to persevere, the revolution almost certainly would have failed. As Nathaniel Greene foresaw as the war went on, he will be the deliverer of his own country.
With the help of God, he was.
Exactly, and he trusted God, and that is why we are where we're at today.
I mean, like I said, he was by no means a perfect man, but he had much to be admired.
Yeah.
Well, I think overall this was a really great book. It sparked my interest again in American history, and I love history.
I do too.
Period.
I do also, Shanda.
And it really makes me want to investigate more. And of course, the reason why we picked 1776 is because in America, July 4th was our Independence Day, even though we didn't technically win our independence.
No.
We had claimed our independence.
That is when we declared
our independence. Our independence. That's right. And to win our independence was much later. But if you want a good summary of 1776 and how it started and be able to get through it in a very fascinating way, this is your book. The next books that we're going to read for next month, and our podcast is scheduled to be recorded August 19th, and that's when we're going to be doing our drawing for the book from Stephanie Black. So keep posting, keep entering. The books for next month will be The Christ Commission by Ognandino, Left Behind by Tim LaHaye, and Copycat by Betsy Brennan Green. So, some really good books. I'm really looking forward to reading. Next month is going to be a lot of good reading, a lot of good discussion. I think it will be very, very good.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I am too. I loved The Christ Commission, and I'm going to be reading The Da Vinci Code, so that if you guys start talking about Da Vinci Code, I'll know what you're talking about.
No pressure, Sheila.
Yeah, no pressure whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. I need to read it so I can know what you guys are talking about.
Yes.
Anyway, well, I think that sums up segment one of episode 6. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you in segment 2.